He trawled for leaves with a big net on a pole. "I'm not lending you a ratty farthing until you pay back the last lot. Why must I forever be giving you handouts? No, don't answer." Denham scooped a fistful of soggy leaves from the net. "Just get back in your taxi and bugger off. I'll only ask you nicely once." "How's Georgette?" I brushed aphids off his shriveled rose petals. "Georgette's going bonkers, surely and steadily. Not that you ever evince an ounce of genuine interest when you don't want money." I watched a worm return to soil and wished I was it. "Denny, I've had a minor run-in with the wrong sort. If I can't get my hands on £60,000, I'm going to take an awful beating. Get them to video it for us." "I'm not joking, Denham."
"Nor am I.
So you're shoddy at being duplicitous. What of it? Why is this my problem?"
"We're brothers. Don't you have a conscience?"
"I sat on the board of a merchant bank for 30 years. An amputated sycamore tree shed once green foliage like desperate men shed once steadfast resolutions. Help, Denny, please. £30,000 would be a start." I had pushed too hard.
"Damn it to hell, Tim, my bank crashed. We were bled dry by those bloodsuckers at Lloyd's. The days when I had that kind of spondulix at my beck and call are gone, gone, gone.
Our house is mortgaged twice over. I'm the mighty fallen. You're the minuscule fallen. Anyway, you've got this ruddy book flying out of every bookshop in the known world." My face said what I had no words for.
"Oh, Christ, you idiot. What's the repayment schedule?"
I looked at my watch. 3 o'clock this afternoon.
"Forget it."
Denham put down his net. "File for bankruptcy. Reynard'll do the papers for you. He's a good man.
A hard bullet to bite, I should know. But it'll get your creditors off your back. The law is clear."
"Law? The only experience my creditors have of the law is squatting over a can in an overcrowded cell."
"Then go to ground."
"These people are very, very well connected with the ground.
Not beyond the M25 they aren't, I bet. Stay with friends."
"Friends?" I crossed off those to whom I owed money, the dead, the disappeared down time's rabbit hole, and I was left with... Denham made his final offer.
"I can't lend you money.
I don't have any. But I'm owed a favor or two by a comfortable place where you could possibly lie low for a while." Temple of the Rat King, Ark of the Soot God, Sphincter of Hades. Yes, King's Cross Station, where, according to Knuckle Sandwich, a blowjob costs only 5 quid. Any of the furthest left 3 cubicles in the men's lavvy downstairs, 24 hours a day. I called Mrs. Latham to explain I would be in Prague for a 3-week meeting with Václav Havel, a lie whose consequences stuck with me like herpes. Mrs. Latham wished me bon voyage. She could handle the Hogginses. Mrs. Latham could handle the 10 plagues of Egypt. I don't deserve her. I know it. I often wonder why she stayed at Cavendish Publishing. It isn't for what I pay her. I navigated the array of ticket types on the ticket machine. Day return with rail card off peak. Cheap day single without rail card on peak. And on and on. But which, oh, which do I need? A menacing finger tapped my shoulder and I jumped a mile. It was only a little old lady advising me that returns are cheaper than singles. I assumed she was doolally, but stone the ruddy crows. 'Twas so. I slid in a banknote with our monarch's head up, then down, then front first, then back first, but each time the machine spat it out. So I joined the queue for a human ticket seller. 31 people were ahead of me. Yes, I counted every one. The ticket sellers drifted in and out from their counters, much as the fancy took them. A looped advertisement on a screen urged me to invest in a stair lift. Finally, finally, my turn was up. Hello, I need a ticket to Hull. The ticket woman toyed with her chunky ethnic rings. Leave in when? As soon as possible. As in to dear? Today usually means as soon as possible, yes. I ain't selling your ticket for to dear. That's them windows over there. This window is advance tickets only. But the red flashing sign told me to come to your counter. Couldn't have done. Move along now, you're holding up the queue. No, that sign ruddy well did send me to this counter. I've been queuing for 20 minutes. She looked interested for the first time. You want me to change the rules? For your benefit. Anger sparked in Timothy Cavendish like forks in microwaves. I want you to evolve problem-solving intelligence and sell me a ticket to Hull. I ain't standing for being addressed in that tone. I'm the ruddy customer. I won't be addressed like that. Get me your ruddy supervisor. I am my supervisor. Snarling an oath from an Icelandic saga, I reclaimed my place at the head of the queue. Oi! Yelled a punk rocker with studs in his cranium. There's a fucking queue! Never apologize, advises Lloyd George. Say it again, only this time, ruder. I know there's a fucking queue. I already queued in it once, and I am not going to queue again, just because Nina Simone over there won't sell me a ruddy ticket. A coloured yeti in a clip-on uniform swooped. What's the bother? This old man here reckons his colostomy bag entitles him to jump the queue, said the skinhead, and make racist slurs about the lady of Afro-Caribbean extraction in the advanced travel window. I couldn't believe I was hearing this. Look, matey. The yeti addressed me with condescension reserved for the handicapped or elderly. We got queues in this country to keep things fair, see? And if you don't like it, you should go back to where you come from. Get it? Do I look like a ruddy Egyptian? Do I? I know there's a queue. How? Because I already queued in this queue. So, this gentleman claims you ain't. Him? Will he still be a gentleman when he daubs asylum scrounger on your housing association flat? His eyeballs swelled. They really did. The transport police can boot you off the premises, or you can join this queue like a member of a civilized society. Whichever is fine by me. Jumping queues is not fine by me. But if I queue all over again, I'll miss my connections. Tough, he enunciated. Diddy. I appealed to the people behind that Sid Rotten look-alike. Maybe they had seen me in the queue, maybe they hadn't, but nobody met my eye. England has gone to the dogs. Oh, the dogs, the ruddy dogs. Over an hour later, London shunted itself southward, taking the curse of the brothers Hoggins with it. Commuters, these hapless souls who enter a lottery of death twice daily on Britain's decrepit railways, packed the dirty train. Airplanes circled in holding patterns over Heathrow, densely as gnats over a summer puddle. Too much matter in this ruddy city. Still, I felt the exhilaration of a journey begun, and I let my guard drop. A volume I once published, True Recollections of a Northern Territory's Magistrate, claims that shark victims experience an anesthetic vision of floating away, all danger gone, into the Pacific blue, at the very moment they are being minced in that funnel of teeth. I, Timothy Cavendish, was that swimmer, watching London roll away. Yes, you, you sly two-paid quizmaster of a city, you and your tenements of Somalians, viaducts of Kingdom Brunel, malls of casualized labor, strata of soot-blitzed bricks and muddy bones of Doctors D, Crippen et al., hot glass office buildings where the blooms of youth harden into aged cacti like my penny-pinching brother. Essex raised its ugly head. When I was a scholarship boy at the local grammar, son of a city hall toiler on the make, this country was synonymous with liberty, success, and Cambridge. Now look at it. Shopping malls and housing estates pursue their creeping invasion of our ancient land. A north sea wind snatched frilly clouds in its teeth and scarpered off to the Midlands. The countryside proper began at last. My mother had a cousin out here. Her family had a big house. I think they moved to Winnipeg for a better life. There, in the shadow of that DIY warehouse, once stood a row of walnut trees where me and Pip Oakes, a childhood chum who died aged 13 under the wheels of an oil tanker, varnished a canoe one summer and sailed it along the Say, sticklebacks in jars. There, right there, around that bend, we lit a fire and cooked beans and potatoes wrapped in silver foil. Come back, oh, come back, is one glimpse all I get. Hedgeless, featureless fields. Essex is Winnipeg now. Stubble was burnt, and the air tasted of crisp bacon sarnies. My thoughts flew off with other fairies, and we were past Saffron Walden when the train juddered to a halt. Said the intercom.
John, is this on? John, what button do I press?
Cough.
Southnet Trains regrets that this service will make an unscheduled stop at the next station due to a missing driver. This unscheduled stop will continue for the duration that it takes to locate an appropriate driver. Southnet Trains assures you we are striving hard, I clearly discerned the background snigger, to restore our normal excellent standard of service. Rail rage, chain reactions down the compartments. Though in our age, crimes are not committed by criminals conveniently at hand, but by executive pens far beyond the mob's reach, back in London's postmodern HQs of glass and steel. Half the mob own shares in what it would pound to atoms anyway. So there we sat. I wished I had brought something to read. At least I had a seat, and I wouldn't have given it up for Helen Keller. The evening was lemon blue. Trackside shadows grew monolithic. Commuters sent calls to families on mobile phones. I wondered how that dodgy Australian magistrate knew what flashed through the minds of the shark-eaten. Lucky express trains with non-missing drivers shot past. I needed the loo, but it didn't bear imagining. I opened my briefcase for a bag of Werner's toffees, but came up with Half-Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery. I leafed through its first few pages. It would be a better book if Hilary V. Hush weren't so artsily-fartsily clever. She had written it in neat little chapteroids, doubtless with one eye on the Hollywood screenplay. Static squealed in the speakers. This is a passenger announcement. Southnet Trains regrets that as a suitable driver for this train cannot be located, we will proceed to Little Chesterford Station, where a complimentary coach will transport passengers on to Cambridge. Those able to are recommended to make alternative travel arrangements, as the coach will not reach Little Chesterford Station. How that name chimed in my memory. For an unknown duration, further details can be found on our website. The train crawled a mile of twilight. Bats and wind-borne rubbish overtook us. Who was driving now, if there wasn't a driver? Stop. Shudder. Doors open. The abler-bodied streamed off the train over the footbridge, leaving me and a couple of taxidermists' cast-offs to limp in their wake at quarter speed. I heaved myself up the steps and paused for breath. There I was, standing on the footbridge of Little Chesterford Station. Ye gods, of all the rural stations for a marooning. The bridle path to Ursula's old house still skirted the cornfield. Not much else did I recognize. The sacred barn of the longest snog was now Essex's premier fitness club. Ursula had met me in her froggy Citroën that night during reading week in our first term, right on this triangle of gravel here. How bohemian, young Tim had thought, to be met by a woman in a car. I was Tutankhamun in my royal barge, rowed by Nubian slaves to the Temple of Sacrifice. Ursula drove me the few hundred yards to Dockery House, commissioned in Art Nouveau times by a Scandinavian consul. We had the place to ourselves while Mater and Pater were in Greece, holidaying with Lawrence Durrell, if memory serves. Memory serves, duplicitous couplet. 4 decades later, the beams of headlights from executive cars in the station car park lit up a freak plague of Daddy Longlegs, and one fugitive publishing gentleman in a flapping raincoat, striding around a field now lying fallow for EU subsidies. You would think a place the size of England could easily hold all the happenings in one humble lifetime without much overlap. I mean, it's not ruddy Luxembourg we live in, but no, we cross, crisscross, and recross our old tracks like figure skaters. Dockery House was still standing, isolated from its neighbours by a privet fence. How opulent the building had felt after my own parents' bland box of suburbia. One day, I promised, I'm going to live in a house like this. Another promise I've broken. At least that one was only to myself. I skirted the edge of the property, down an access road to a building site. A sign read, Hazel Close, highly prized executive homes in the heart of England. Upstairs, at Dockery, lights were on. I imagined a childless couple listening to a wireless. The old stained glass door had been replaced by something more burglar-proof. That reading week, I'd entered Dockery, ready to peel off my shameful virginity. But I'd been so in awe of my divine Cleopatra, so nervous, so eyeballed up on her father's whiskey, so floppy with green sap that, well, I'd rather draw a veil over the embarrassment of that night, even at 40 years remove. Very well, 47 years remove. That same white-leafed oak had scratted at Ursula's window as I attempted to perform, long after I could decently pretend I was still warming up. Ursula had a gramophone record of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto in her bedroom, that room there, where the electric candle glows in the window. To this day, I cannot hear Rachmaninoff without flinching. The odds of Ursula still living at Dockery House was ilch, I knew. Last I heard, she was running a PR office in Los Angeles. Nonetheless, I squeezed myself through the evergreen hedge and pressed my nose up against the unlit, uncurtained dining-room window, trying to peer in. That autumn night, long ago, Ursula had served a blob of grilled cheese on a slice of ham on a breast of chicken. Right there, right here. I could still taste it. I can still taste it as I write these words. Flash! The room was lit electric marigold, and in waltzed, backwards, luckily for me, a little witch with red corkscrew curls. Mummy! I half heard, half lip-read through the glass. Mummy! And in came Mummy, with the same corkscrew curls. This being proof enough for me that Ursula's family had long vacated the house, I backtracked into the shrubbery. But I turned once more and resumed my spying because, well, because, je suis un homme solitaire. Mummy was repairing a broken broomstick while the girl sat on the table swinging her legs. An adult werewolf came in and removed his mask, and oddly, though not so oddly, I suppose, I recognized him, that Current Affairs TV presenter, one of Felix Finch's tribe. Jeremy someone, Heathcliff eyebrows, terrier manners, you know the chap. He took some insulation tape from the Welsh dresser drawer and muscled in on the broomstick repair job. Then Grandma entered this domestic freeze. And damn me once, damn me twice, damn me always, make it nice, 'twas Ursula. The Ursula, my Ursula. Behold that spry, elderly lady.
In my memory, she hadn't aged a day. What makeup artist had savaged her dewy youth? The same one who savaged yours, Timbo. She spoke, and her daughter and granddaughter giggled. Yes, giggled, and I giggled too. What? What did she say? Tell me the joke. She stuffed a red stocking with newspaper balls. A devil's tail. She attached it to her posterior with a safety pin, and a memory from a university Halloween ball cracked on the hard rim of my heart, and the yolk dribbled out. She'd dressed like a devilette then, too. She'd put on red face paint. We'd kissed all night, just kissed. And in the morning we found a builder's cafe that sold dirty mugs of strong milky tea and enough eggs to fill, to kill, the Swiss Army. Toast and hot canned tomatoes, HP sauce. Be honest, Cavendish, was any other breakfast in your life ever so delectable? So drunk was I on nostalgia, I ordered myself to leave before I did anything stupid. A nasty voice just a few feet away said this, "Don't move a muscle, or I'll macassar you and put you in a stew." Shocked, jet-assisted vertical ruddy takeoff. Luckily, my would-be butcherer was not a day older than 10, and his chainsaw's teeth were cardboard, but his bloodied bandages were rather effective. In a low voice, I told him so. He wrinkled his face at me.
"Are you Grandma Ursula's friend?"
"Once upon a time, yes, I was."
"What have you come to the party as? Where's your costume?"
Time to leave. I edged back into the evergreen. "This is my costume." He picked his nose.
"A dead man digged up from the churchyard?"
"Charmed, but no. I've come as the ghost of Christmas past."
"But it's Halloween, not Christmas."
"No." I slapped my forehead.
"Really?" "Yeah. Then I'm 10 months late. This is terrible. I'd better get back before my absence is noticed
and remarked upon." The boy did a cartoon kung fu pose and waved his chainsaw at me.
"Not so fast, Green Goblin. You're a trespasser. I'm telling the police of you."
"War. Telltale tit, are you? Two can play at that game. If you tell on me, I'll tell my friend, the ghost of Christmas future, where your house is, and do you know what he'll do to you?" The wide-eyed Shitletto shook his head, shaken and stirred. "When your family is all tucked up asleep in your snug little beds, he'll slide into your house through the crack under the door and eat your puppy." The venom in my bile duct pumped fast. "He'll leave its curly tail under your pillow, and you'll get blamed. Your little friends will all scream, 'Puppy Slayer,' whenever they see you coming. You'll grow old and friendless and die alone, miserably, on Christmas morning, half a century from now. So if I were you, I wouldn't breathe a word to anyone about seeing me." I pushed myself through the hedge before he could take it all in. As I was heading back to the station along the pavement, the wind carried his sob.
"But I don't even have a puppy."
I hid behind Private Eye in the health center's wellness cafe, which was doing a fine trade with us maroonies. I half expected a furious Ursula to turn up with her grandchild and a local bobby. Private lifeboats came to rescue the stockbrokers. Old Father Timothy offers this advice to his younger readers, included for free in the price of this memoir. Conduct your life in such a way that when your train breaks down in the eve of your years, you have a warm, dry car driven by a loved one, or a hired one, it matters not, to take you home. A venerable coach arrived 3 scotches later. Venerable? Ruddy Edwardian. I had to endure chatty students all the way to Cambridge. Boyfriend worries, sadistic lecturers, demonic housemates, reality TV. Struth, I had no idea children of their age were so hyperactive. When I finally reached Cambridge Station, I looked for a telephone box to tell Aurora House, not to expect me until the following day. But the first two telephones were vandalized. In Cambridge, I ask you. And only when I got to the third did I look at the address and see that Denham had neglected to write the number. I found a hotel for commercial travellers next to a laundrette. I forget its name, but I knew from its reception that the place was a crock of cat crap, and as usual my first impression was spot on. I was too raddy-whacked to shop around for something nicer, however, and my wallet was too starved. My room had high windows with blinds I couldn't lower, because I am not 12 feet tall. The khaki pellets in the bathtub were indeed mouse droppings. The shower knob came off in my hand, and the hot water was tepid. I fumigated the room with cigar smoke, and lay on my bed trying to recall the bedrooms of all my lovers in order, looking down the mucky telescope of time. Prince Rupert and the boys failed to stir. I felt strangely unconcerned with the idea of the Hoggins brothers plundering my flat back in Putney. Must be lean pickings compared to most of their heists, if knuckle sandwich is anything to go by. A few nice first editions, but little else of value. My television died the night George Bush II snatched the throne, and I haven't dared replace it. Madam X took back her antiques and heirlooms. I ordered a triple scotch from room service. Damn me if I'd share a bar with a cabal of salesmen boasting about boobs and bonuses. When my treble whiskey finally came, it was actually a stingy double, so I said so. The ferrety adolescent just shrugged. No apology, just a shrug. I asked him to lower my blind, but he took one look and huffed, "Can't reach that." I gave him a frosty, "That will be all then," instead of a tip. He broke wind as he left, poisonously. I read more of Half Lives, but fell asleep just after Rufus Sixsmith was found murdered. In a lucid dream, I was looking after a little asylum-seeker boy who begged for a go in one of those rides in the corners of supermarkets you put 50p into. I said, "Oh, all right." But when the child climbed out, he had turned into Nancy Reagan. How could I explain that to his mother? I woke up in darkness with a mouth like superglue. The mighty Gibbons' Assessment of History, little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind, ticker-taped by for no apparent reason. Timothy Cavendish's Time on Earth in 13 words. I re-fought old arguments, then fought arguments that have never even existed. I smoked a cigar until the high windows showed streaks of a watery dawn. I shaved my jowls. A pinched Ulster woman downstairs served a choice of burnt or frozen toast with sachets of lipstick-coloured jam and unsalted butter. I remembered Jake Balakowski's quip about Normandy, Cornwall with something to eat. Back at the station, my woes began afresh when I tried to get a refund on yesterday's disrupted journey. The ticket waller, whose pimples bubbled as I watched, was as intractably dense as his counterpart in King's Cross. The corporation breeds them from the same stem cell. My blood pressure neared its record. "What do you mean yesterday's ticket is now invalid? It's not my fault my ruddy train broke down." "Not our fault, neither. Southnet run the trains. We're ticket lords, see?" "Then to whom do I complain?" "Well, Southnet Loco are owned by a holding company in Dusseldorf, who are owned by that mobile phone company in Finland, so you'd be best off trying someone in Helsinki. You should thank your lucky stars it wasn't a derailment. Get a lot of those these days." Sometimes the fluffy bunny of incredulity zooms round the bend so rapidly that the greyhound of language is left agog in the starting cage. A feisty stagger was needed to reach the next train before it left, only to find it had been cancelled. But luckily, the train before mine was so late that it still hadn't departed. All the seats were taken, and I had to squeeze into a 3-inch slot. I lost my balance when the train pulled away, but a human crumple zone buffered my fall. We stayed like that, half-fallen, the diagonal people. Cambridge outskirts were all science parks now. Ursula and I went punting below that quaint bridge, where those biotech space-age cuboids now sit cloning humans for shady Koreans. Oh, aging is ruddy unbearable. The eyes we were yearn to breathe the world's air again. But can they ever break out from these calcified cocoons? Oh, can they, hell? Witchy trees bent before the enormous sky. Our train had made an unscheduled and unexplained stop on a blasted heath for how long I do not recall. My watch was stuck in the middle of last night. I miss my Ingersoll even today. My fellow passengers' features melted into forms that were half familiar. An estate agent behind me, yakking on his mobile telephone, I could swear he was my sixth-form hockey captain. The grim woman, two seats ahead, reading A Movable Feast. Isn't she that Inland Revenue Gorgon who gave me such a grilling a few years ago? Finally, the couplings whimpered, and the train limped off at a slow haul to another country station whose flaky name board read Adelstrop. A voice with a bad cold announced,
"Said Trello Trains regrets that due to a braking system failure, this train will make a brief stop at this..."
Sneeze.
"Station. Passengers are directed to alight here and wait for a substitute train."
My fellow travellers gasped, groaned, swore, shook their heads.
"Said Trello Trains apologises for any..."
Sneeze.
"Inconvenience this may cause and assures you we are working hard to restore our normal excellent standard of..."
Huge sneeze.
"Service. Here's a tissue, John."
Fact. Rolling stock in this country is built in Hamburg or somewhere, and when the German engineers test British-bound trains, they use imported lengths of our buggered, privatized tracks because the decently maintained European rails won't provide accurate testing conditions. Who really won the ruddy war? I should have fled the Hogginses up the Great North Road on a ruddy pogo stick. I elbowed my way into the grubby cafe, bought a pie that tasted of shoe polish, and a pot of tea with cork crumbs floating in it, and eavesdropped on a pair of Shetland pony breeders. Despondency makes one hanker after lives one never led. Why have you given your life to books, T.C.? Dull, dull, dull. The memoirs are bad enough, but all that ruddy fiction. Hero goes on a journey. Stranger comes to town. Somebody wants something. They get it or they don't. Will is pitted against will. Admire me, for I am a metaphor. I groped my way to the ammonia-smelling gents, where a joker had stolen the bulb. I had just unzipped myself when a voice arose from the shadows.
"Here, mister. Got a light or something?"
Steadying my cardiac arrest, I fumbled for my lighter. The flame conjured a Rastafarian in Holbein embers, just a few inches away, a cigar held in his thick lips.
"Thanks," whispered my black Virgil, inclining his head to bring the tip into the flame.
"You're, most welcome." "Quite," I said. His wide, flat nose twitched.
"So where are you heading, man?"
My hand checked my wallet was still there.
"Hull,"
a witless fib ran wild,
"to return a novel to a librarian who works there,
a very famous poet, at the university. It's in my bag. It's called Half Lives." The Rastafarian's cigar smelt of compost. I can never guess what they're really thinking. Not that I've ever really known any. I'm not a racialist, but I do believe the ingredients in so-called melting pots take generations to melt.
"Mister,"
the Rastafarian told me,
"you need..."
And I flinched.
"Some ideas."
I obeyed his offer and sucked on his turd-thick cigar.
"Ruddy hell! What is this stuff?"
He made a noise like a didgeridoo at the root of his throat.
"Dad don't grow in Marlborough country." My head enlarged itself by a magnitude of many hundreds, Alice-style, and became a multi-story car park wherein dwelt 1,001 operatic Citroëns.
"My word, you can say that again,"
mouthed the man formerly known as Tim Cavendish. Next thing I remember, I was on the train again, wondering who had walled up my compartment with moss-stained bricks.
"We're ready for you now, Mr. Cavendish," a bald, spectacled coot told me.
Nobody was there, or anywhere, only a cleaner making his way down the vacant train, putting litter into a sack. I lowered myself onto the platform. The cold sank its fangs into my exposed neck and frisked me for uninsulated patches. Back in King's Cross? No, this was wintriest Gdansk. In a panic, I realized I didn't have my bag and umbrella. I climbed aboard and retrieved them from the luggage rack. My muscles seemed to have atrophied in my sleep. Outside, a baggage cart passed, driven by a Modigliani. Where in hell was this place?
"You're in Olpal," the Modigliani answered.
"Arabic?" My brain proposed the following. A Eurostar train had stopped at Adelstrop. I had boarded and slept all the way to Istanbul Central. Addled brain. I needed a clear sign in English. "Welcome to Hull. Praise be, my journey was nearly over. When had I last been this far north? Never, that's when. I gulped cold air to stub out a sudden urge to throw up.
That's right, Tim, drink it down.
The offended stomach supplies pictures of the cause of its discomfort, and the Rastafarian cigar flashed before me. The station was painted in all blacks. I rounded a corner and found two luminous clock faces hung above the exit, but clocks in disagreement are worse than no clock at all. No watcher at the gates wanted to see my exorbitantly priced ticket, and I felt cheated. Out front, a curb crawler prowled here, a window blinked there, music waxed and waned from a pub across the bypass.
"Spare change?" asked.
No, demanded. No, accused. A miserable dog in a blanket. His master's nose, eyebrows, and lips were so pierced with ironmongery that a powerful electromagnet would have shredded his face in a single pass. What do these people do at airport metal detectors?
"Got any change?"
I saw myself as he saw me, a frail old giffer in a friendless late city. The dog rose, scenting vulnerability. An invisible guardian took my elbow and led me to a taxi rank. The taxi seemed to have been going round the same roundabout for a miniature eternity. A howling singer on the radio strummed a song about how everything that dies some day comes back. Heaven forfend, remember the monkey's paw. The driver's head was far, far too big for his shoulders. He must have had that elephant man disease. But when he turned round, I made out his turban. He was bemoaning his clientele.
"Always they say, bet it ain't this cold where you're from, eh? And always I say, dead wrong, mate. You've obviously never visited Manchester in February."
"You do know the way to Aurora House, don't you?" I asked, and the Sikh said,
"Look, we've arrived already."
The narrow driveway ended at an imposing Edwardian residence of indeterminate size.
16 Squid, Zachary.
I don't know anyone of that name. He looked at me puzzled, then repeated,
16 quid exactly.
Oh, yes. My wallet was not in my trouser pockets, or my jacket pocket, or my shirt pocket, nor did it reappear in my trouser pockets. The awful truth smacked my face.
"I've been ruddy robbed. I resent the insinuation. My taxi has a municipal meter."
"No, you don't understand. My wallet's been stolen."
"Oh, then I understand."
"Good, he understands."
"I understand very well."
The wrath of the subcontinent swarmed in the dark.
"You're thinking that curry muncher knows whose side the fuzzle tick."
"Nonsense," I protested. "Look, I've got coins, change. Yes, a pocket full of change. Here. Yes, thank God. Yes, I think I've got it." He counted his ducats.
"Dip. Take it.
I had emptied all the shrapnel into his other hand and scrambled outside, straight into a ditch. From my accident victim's eye view, I saw the taxi speed away, and I suffered a disagreeable flashback to my Greenwich mugging. It wasn't the watch or even the bruises or the shock that had scarred me so. It was that I was a man who had once faced down and bested a quartet of Arab ragamuffins in Aden, but in the girl's eyes I was old, merely old, not behaving the way an old man should. Invisible, silent and scared, was itself sufficient provocation. I scaled the ramp up to the imposing glass doors. The reception area glowed grail gold. I knocked, and a woman who could have been cast for the stage musical of Florence Nightingale smiled at me. I felt like someone had waved a magic wand and said, "Cavendish, all your troubles are over. Florence, let me in." "Welcome to Aurora House, Mr. Cavendish." "Oh, thank you, thank you. Today has been too ruddy awful for words. An angel incarnate. The main thing is you've arrived safely now. Look, there is a slight fiscal embarrassment. I should mention at this time, you see, on my way here, all you need to worry about now is getting a good night's sleep. Everything is taken care of. Just sign here, and I can show you to your room. It's a nice, quiet one overlooking the garden. You'll love it." Moist-eyed with gratitude, I followed her to my sanctuary. The hotel was modern, spotless, with very soft lighting in the sleepy corridors. I recognized aromas from my childhood, but couldn't quite identify them. Up the wooden hill to Bedfordshire. My room was simple, its sheets crisp and clean, with towels ready on the heated rail. "Will you be all right from now, Mr. Cavendish?" "Bliss, my dear." "Sweet dreams, then." I knew they would be. I took a quick shower, slipped into my gym jams, and cleaned my teeth. My bed was firm, but comfy as beaches in Tahiti. The Hoggins horrors were east of the Horn, I was scot-free, and Denny, dear as Denham, was footing my bill. Brother in need, brother indeed. Sirens sang in my marshmallow pillows. In the morning, life would begin afresh, afresh, afresh. This time round, I would do everything right. In the morning. Fate is fond of booby-trapping those three little words. I awoke to discover a not-so-young woman with a pageboy haircut rifling through my personal effects like a bargain hunter. "What the ruddy hell are you doing in my room, you pilfering warty sow?" I half-roared, half-wheezed. The female put down my jacket without guilt. "Because you are new, I will not have you eat soap powder. This time, be warned, I do not stand for offensive language in Aurora House, not from anyone, and I never make idle threats, Mr. Cavendish, never." A robber reprimanding his victim for bad language. I'll ruddy well talk to you how I ruddy well like you, stinking ruddy thief. "Make me eat soap powder? I'd like to see you try. Let's call hotel security. Let's call the police. You ask about offensive language, and I'll ask about breaking entry and theft." She came over to my bed and slapped me hard across the chops. I was so shocked, I just fell back onto my pillow. "A disappointing start. I am Mrs. Noakes. You do not wish to cross me." Was this some sort of a kinky S&M hotel? Had a madwoman broken into my room after learning my name from the hotel register? "Smoking is discouraged here. I will have to confiscate these cigars. The lighter is far too dangerous for you to play with. And what, pray, are these?" She dangled my keys. "Keys? What do you think they are? Keys go walkies? Let's give them to Mrs. Judd for safekeeping, shall we? Let's not give them to anyone, you crazy dragon. You strike me? You rob me? What kind of ruddy hotel hires thieves for chambermaids?" The creature stuffed her booty into a little burglar's bag. "No more valuables to be taken care of? Put those items back now, or I'll have your job, I swear it."
I'll take that as a no. Breakfast is 8 sharp. Boiled eggs with toast soldiers today. None for the tardy.
I got dressed the moment she was gone and looked for the phone. There wasn't one. After a very quick wash, my bathroom had been designed for disabled people. It was all rounded edges and fitted with handrails. I hurried to reception, determined to have due justice. I had acquired a limp, but was unsure how. I was lost. Baroque music lilted in identical chair-lined corridors. A leprous gnome gripped my wrist and showed me a jar of hazelnut butter.
"If you want to take this home, I'll jolly well tell you why I don't."
"You've mistaken me for someone else." I scraped the creature's hand off mine and passed through a dining room area, where the guests were seated in rows and waitresses were bringing bowls in from the kitchen. What was so odd? The youngest guests were in their 70s. The oldest guests were 300+. Was it the week after the schools went back? I had it. You probably spotted it pages ago, dear reader. Aurora House was a nursing home for the elderly. That ruddy brother of mine, this was his idea of a joke. Mrs. Judd and her oil of ole smile were manning reception. "Hello, Mr. Cavendish. Feeling super this morning?" "Yes. No. An absurd misunderstanding has occurred." "Is that a fact?" "It most certainly is a fact. I checked in last night believing Aurora House was a hotel. My brother made the booking, you see. But, oh, it's his idea of a practical joke, not in the least bit funny. His contemptible ruse only worked because a Rastafarian gave me a puff of a sinister cigar in Adelstrop, and also the ruddy stem cell twins who sold me my ticket here. They wore me out so. But listen, you have a bigger problem, closer to home. Some demented bitch called Noakes is running about the place impersonating a chambermaid. She's probably riddled with Alzheimer's, but yowee, she's got a slap on her. She stole my keys! Now, in a go-go bar in Phuket, that'd be par for the course. But in an old Rex home in Hull, you'd get closed down if I was an inspector, you know." Mrs. Judd's smile was now battery acid. "I want my keys back," she made me say, "right away." "Aurora House is your home now, Mr. Cavendish. Your signature authorizes us to apply compliancy, and I'd get out of the habit of referring to my sister in those tones." "Compliancy? Signature? Sister?" "The custody document you signed last night. Your residency papers." "No, no, no. That was the hotel registry. Never mind. It's all academic. I'll be on my way after breakfast. Make that before breakfast. I smelt the slops. My, this will make a heck of a dinner party story, once I've strangled my brother. Bill him, by the way. Only I must insist on having my keys returned, and you'd better call me a cab. Most of our guests get cold feet on their first mornings. My feet are quite warm, but I haven't made myself clear. If you don't, Mr. Cavendish, why don't you eat your breakfast first and—" "Keys! We have your written permission to hold your valuables in the office safe. Then I must speak with the management." "That would be my sister, Nurse Noakes."
"Noakes. Management.
Nurse Noakes."
"Then I must speak with the Board of Governors or the owner."
"They would be me."
"Look, Gulliver and Lilliputians,
you're breaking the ruddy Anti-Incarceration Act or whatever it is."
"You'll find temper tantrums won't help you at Aurora House."
"Your telephone, please. I wish to call the police."
"Residents aren't permitted to."
"I am not a ruddy resident. And since you won't give me back my keys, I'll be back later this morning with one very pissed-off officer of the law."
I shoved the main door, but it shoved back harder. Some ruddy security lock. I tried the fire door across the porch. Locked. Over Mrs. Judd's protests, I smashed a release catch with a little hammer. The door opened, and I was a free man. Ruddy hell, the cold smacked my face with an iron spade.
Now I knew why northerners go in for beards, woad, and body grease. I marched down the curving driveway through worm-blasted rhododendrons, resisting a strong temptation to break into a run. I haven't run since the mid-70s. I was level with a lawnmower contraption when a shaggy giant in groundsman's overalls rose from the earth like Ye Greener Knichte. He was removing the remains of a hedgehog from its blades with his bloody hands. Off somewhere. You bet I am. To the land of the living. I strode on. Leaves turned to soil beneath my feet. Thus it is trees eat themselves. I was disorientated to discover how the drive wound back to the dining room annex. I had taken a bad turn. The undead of Aurora House watched me through the wall of glass. "Soylent Green is people!" I mocked their hollow stares. "Soylent Green is made of people!" They looked puzzled. I am, alas, the last of my tribe. One of the wrinklies tapped on the window and pointed behind me. I turned, and the ogre slung me over his shoulder. My breath was squeezed out with his every stride. He stank of fertilizer. "I've better things to do than this." "Then go and do them." I struggled in vain to get him in a neck lock, but I don't think he even noticed. So I used my superior powers of language to chain the villain. "You cruddy, ruddy, rugger-bugger yob. This is assault. This is illegal confinement." He bear-hugged me several degrees tighter to silence me, and I am afraid I bit his ear. A strategic mistake. In one powerful yank, my trousers were pulled from my waist. Was he going to bugger me? What he did was even less pleasant. He laid me on the body of his mowing machine, pinned me down with one hand, and caned me with a bamboo cane in the other. The pain cracked across my unfleshy shanks, once, twice, again, 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 again. Christ, such pain! I shouted, then cried, then whimpered for him to stop. Whack, whack, whack! Nurse Noakes finally ordered the giant to desist. My buttocks were two giant wasp stings. The woman's voice hissed in my ear. "The world outside has no place for you. Aurora House is where you live now. Is reality sinking in? Or shall I ask Mr. Withers here to go over things one more time?" "Tell her to go to hell," warned my spirit, "or you'll regret it later." "Tell her what she wants to hear," shrieked my nervous system, "or you'll regret it now." The spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak. I was sent to my room without breakfast. I plotted vengeance, litigation, and torture. I inspected my cell. Door locked from outside, no keyhole. Window that opened only 6 inches. Heavy-duty sheets made of egg carton fibers with plastic undersheet. Armchair, washable seat cover. Moppable carpet. Easy wipe wallpaper. Ensuite bathroom. Soap, shampoo, flannel, ratty towel, no window. Picture of cottage captioned, "A house is made by hands, but a home is made by hearts." Prospects for breakout, piss poor. Still, I believed my confinement would not last until noon. One of several exits must open up. The management would realize its mistake, apologize profusely, sack the offending Noakes, and beg me to take compensation in cash. Or Denham would learn his gag had backfired and command my release. Or the accountant would realize nobody was paying my bills and boot me out. Or Mrs. Latham would report me missing, my disappearance would feature on Crime Watch UK, and the police would trace my whereabouts. Around 11, the door was unlocked. I readied myself to reject apologies and go for the jugular. A once stately woman sailed in, 70 years old, 80, 85, who knows when they're that old. A rickety greyhound in a blazer followed his mistress. "Good morning," began the woman. I stood and did not offer my visitors a seat. "I beg to differ."
"My name is Gwendolyn Bendinks."
"Don't blame me." Nonplussed, she took the armchair.
"This,"
She indicated the greyhound. "He's Gordon Warlock Williams. Why don't you take a seat? We head the residence committee."
"Very nice for you, but since I am not a..."
"I had intended to introduce myself at breakfast, but the morning's unpleasantness occurred before we could take you under our wing."
"All water under the bridge now, Cavendish,"
gruffed Gordon Warlock Williams. "No one'll mention it again, boyo, rest assured."
Welsh.
Yes, he would have to be Welsh.
Mrs. Bendinks leant forward.
"But understand this, Mr. Cavendish. Boat rockers are not welcome here."
"Then expel me, I beg you."
"Aurora House does not expel," said the sanctimonious Moo. "But you will be medicated if your behaviour warrants it, for your own protection."
"Ominous, no? I had seen one flew over the cuckoo's nest with an extraordinarily talentless but wealthy and widowed poetess, whose collected works, Verses Wild and Wayward, I was annotating, but who was less widowed than initially claimed, alas.
Look, I'm sure you're a reasonable woman."
The oxymoron passed without comment.
"So read my lips.
I am not supposed to be here.
I checked into Aurora House, believing it to be a hotel."
"Ah, but we do understand, Mr. Cavendish," Gwendolyn Bendinks nodded. "No, you don't.
Everyone's visited by the Glam family at first, but you'll soon cheer up when you see how your loved ones have acted in your best interests."
"All my loved ones are dead or bonkers or at the BBC, except my prankster brother.
You can see it, can't you, dear reader? I was a man in a horror B-movie asylum. The more I ranted and raged, the more I proved that I was exactly where I should be."
"This is the best hotel you'll ever stay in, boyo."
His teeth were biscuit-coloured. "Were he a horse, you couldn't have given him away.
A 5-star one, look you. Meals get provided, all your laundry is done, activities laid on from crochet to croquet. No confusing bills, no youngsters joyriding in your motor. Aurora House is a ball. Just obey the regulations and stop rubbing Nurse Nooks up the wrong way. She's not a cruel woman."
"Unlimited power in the hands of limited people always leads to cruelty." Warlock Williams looked at me as if I had spoken in tongues.
"Solzhenitsyn.
Better Sikoid was always good enough for Marjorie and me. But look you here. I felt just the same in my first week. Barely spoke to a soul. Eh, Mrs. Bendinks? A major sourpuss, eh?"
"A Maximus sourpuss, Mr. Warlock Williams.
But now I'm happy as a pig in clover, eh?"
Mrs. Bendinks smiled. 'Twas a ghastly sight.
"We're here to help you reorientate. Now, I understand you were in publishing. Sadly," she tapped her head, "Mrs. Birkin is less able to record residence committee meeting minutes than she once was. A fine opportunity for you to jolly well get involved."
"I still am in publishing. Do I look like I should be here?"
The silence was intolerable.
"Oh, get out!"
"Disappointed?"
She gazed at the leaf-littered lawn, dotted with worm casts.
"Aurora House is your world now, Mr. Cavendish."
My head was cork, and the corkscrew was Gwendolyn Bendinks.
"Yes, you are in a rest home. The day has come. Your stay can be miserable or pleasant, but your stay is permanent. Think on, Mr. Cavendish."
She knocked on the door. Unseen forces let my tormentors exit, but slammed it shut in my face. I noticed that for the duration of the interview, my flies had been wide open.
"Behold your future, Cavendish the Younger. You will not apply for membership, but the tribe of the elderly will claim you. Your present will not keep pace with the world's. This slippage will stretch your skin, sag your skeleton, erode your hair and memory, make your skin turn opaque so your twitching organs and blue cheese veins will be semi-visible. You will venture out only in daylight, avoiding weekends and school holidays. Language, too, will leave you behind, betraying your tribal affiliations whenever you speak.
on escalators, on trunk roads, in supermarket aisles. The living will overtake you incessantly. Elegant women will not see you. Store detectives will not see you. Salespeople will not see you unless they sell stairlifts or fraudulent insurance policies. Only babies, cats, and drug addicts will